Well, good morning, everybody. It looks like we've got critical mass at least. Welcome and good morning. This is Sean Martini with Farm Bureau. I appreciate y'all jumping on the call this morning. Just as a reminder, if you haven't had a chance to yet, please put your phone on mute while we listen to our presenters, and there will be time at the end of the presentation for questions. Appreciate you jumping on this morning with Dan Nordberg, who's the director of the Office of Rural Affairs and the Regional Administrator with the Small Business Administration, and his counterpart, Ms. Frances Padilla, who is the Colorado District Director for the Small Business Administration. Of course, we had an initial call on the Paycheck Protection Program and other Small Business Administration programs prior to passage of the CARES Act a couple of months ago, which seems like an eternity now. And now, with the passage of the Paycheck Protection Flexibility Act, which provides some additional provisions to the Paycheck Protection Act, we'd like to have Dan and Frances back on again to walk us through some of the changes and how the program is shaping up. So Dan and Frances, thank you guys for being here. And with that, I will turn the microphone and the presentation over to you.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sean, and good morning, everybody. It's great to be with you today. And certainly over the past few months, it's been nice to become better acquainted with the Farm Bureau staff, as well as your membership, as part of the agency's ongoing discussions relating to the inclusion of ag enterprises for both the Paycheck Protection Program and then certainly most recently our Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program. And that's been somewhat unique for SBA, because for us, for more than 30 years, we've been prohibited by law from providing disaster assistance to ag producers. However, as a result of just the unprecedented situation we find ourselves, as well as the actions of the administration, Congress, farmers and ranchers, and other agricultural enterprises now have access to emergency working capital necessary to hopefully help provide some stability to our nation's important food supply chains. And so, for context, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan has been what SBA has traditionally utilized to respond to a natural disaster in a specific community, everything from a wildfire to a hurricane. It wasn't until March, when Congress passed the Coronavirus Preparedness and Supplemental Appropriation Act, that we were given permission to use it for small businesses adversely impacted by COVID-19. And then just more recently, with the expansion of the CARES Act, where Congress authorized use of this program for agricultural enterprises. Now, as it pertains to our other flagship program, and I think this is the flagship program, the Paycheck Protection Program, over the past 2 months, we've distributed over $500 billion, over $500 billion in PPP loans. And that is more loans than we have done over the past two decades combined, just in the past 2 months. Yet, in spite of that, we still are in a position where we have over $130 billion remaining in that program. So really want to emphasize that as we're going through this presentation. And if you take one thing away, there is some still time in this program. June 30th is the deadline to make application, but we do still have plenty of funds available. And that has not, we need to get that out there. And so we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about that today. To discuss these programs in greater depth, at this time, I'm going to turn it over to our excellent Colorado District Director, Frances Padilla, who's going to walk over both programs. Frances, are you there?
I'm on.
Great. Take it away.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for having us on today and for giving us an opportunity to kind of give you some updates on where we stand with SBA's programs and materials and all of our resources that are related to COVID-19 as they currently stand. And I love to emphasize that as they currently stand, because as we all know, you know, nobody expected a pandemic of this size. And so as programs are being developed, they really have become overly fluid in some cases, and so we rush to try to give you as much information as possible when new updates or FAQs or guidance is rolled out. So I just want to make sure that you know where to find current information. You can always go to, especially on Paycheck Protection Program, which we're going to discuss today, you can always go to sba.gov/PPP, and it's just the short version of jumping in there and finding all things Paycheck Protection Program, including when we update new forms, if we have new guidance. It gives you links back to the FAQs, which are posted both on Treasury's website and on ours. So if you're looking for a repository source, that would be the main page. Before I get into the changes under the Flexibility Act, I do want to give you a couple of updates on some other programs that were enacted, some pre-CARE and some after the CARES Act, that are SBA resources that maybe you were not aware of. There's small business debt relief that happened both pre-CARES and after CARES Act 2.0. So if anyone on the call or anyone you know had a prior SBA disaster loan, we're talking from another disaster period, not including the EIDL associated with COVID right now, the SBA administrator early on made the decision that we would provide some debt relief and defer those payments for a period of 12 months. That already happened administratively. You didn't have to request it. Nobody had to do anything else. It was just automatic. So those payments have been deferred probably since about March, and they'll continue to be deferred until next year. Also, under the CARES Act, if you're a current 7A Community Advantage 504 or a microloan client, those borrowers were also relieved of obligation to pay principal interest and some associated fees that were owed on these loans if they were in regular servicing status. So that means a good standing to us. And we would be making those payments for a period of 6 month period, usually beginning with the first payment due on the loan at the end of the March payment. So after that was enacted, lenders subsequently submitted their documentation, and now we're continuing to make those payments on behalf of existing SBA borrowers for a period of just 6 months. Many of you might not know that this debt relief also applies to any new SBA loans. We're talking regular SBA guaranteed loans, not COVID, not PPP, not EIDL, that are closed and dispersed through September 27th. So if you do get a 7A or a 504 or a microloan or a community advantage loan between now and the end of September, and your lender is able to close it and disperse it, and then it's put into good standing, okay, regular servicing, then you can also take advantage of that payment deferral. So I wanted you to be aware of that in case you're seeking other sources of funding. I also wanted to give you an update on some of our efforts to reach underserved communities. We're now providing more information in languages other than English to help small business owners navigate all of our COVID-19 related resources. So presently the materials are available in 17 different languages. And we're going to be translating and posting more periodically. And of course, we will need to revise any of our materials that we already have to reflect all the changes as of the PPP Flexibility Act that was just passed and signed. But if you're looking for that information, you can go to sba.gov. There's always a COVID-19 banner that's standing right now from our main webpage. So you can just click on that and scroll down to the information in the other languages section. Please use this collateral material as you deem necessary. You know, give it to other folks if that are interested in our programs. We appreciate that. A little bit on EIDL Advance and EIDL Loans. So around the beginning of May, the EIDL Rapid Portal reopened to accept new applications, as Dan said, from agricultural enterprises, and that was authorized by Congress under the CARES Act 2.0. So as he mentioned, again, this is the first time in history that we're ever opening this EIDL program to agricultural producers and other enterprises. And so there are some tweaks that we need to work out on some of these issues. But if you are an EIDL applicant and you've gone through the process and received your advance and they're moving towards a long-term loan and you have any questions, please, you can always call customer service at Disaster Assistance, but we want you to know that the SBA district office is also open for business virtually right now for the most part, but you can contact us. And if you have questions or issues, we'll be happy to try to help you navigate through those. As it stands right now, new applications for EIDL money are only being accepted by the agricultural community. So if you already applied for EIDL and you received your advance and your application started with a 3, then you've taken all the steps you can until your long term comes up in the queue for processing. My understanding is that on prior EIDL applications, that a lot of decision letters are going out in mass over the last few weeks. So if you have questions, the letter should provide information on how to proceed if you've already received one of those. I do want to give you a sincere apology that since this program is unilaterally administered by our Office of Disaster Assistance, district offices such as mine don't have access to their system to check statuses. But you can send your application number to this email, disastercustomerservice@sba.gov. We'll post it in the chat. And what they do is create a ticket, and then they'll answer the inquiries as they get through the queue. You can also call the Disaster Assistance Customer Service Center. And let me give you this number, and again, we'll post in the chat, 1-800-659-2955. 1-800-659-2955. You get a customer service representative, and you can talk through some of your issues. Let me give you a little bit on our progress on EIDL programs in Colorado. So these numbers are as of the end of May. In Colorado, we had 62,343 advances honored, and the total for that was a little over $198 million. This is in the advance money. As of the long-term loans, at the end of May, we had about a little over 14,000 loans that were offered, and that it amounted to about $1.1 billion. So that's on the long-term loan side. I do want also to make you aware that if you're navigating through the space of, you know, looking for SBA programs or other programs, whether they're federal sources or not, from the very beginning of the crisis, from the federal government to the state down to all the regional economic development districts and all of our partners, we stood up rapid response teams. So if you can't get a hold of one of us, and I hope that you can, whether on the disaster side or in my office, and you need to ask questions, even if it's about unemployment insurance for employees, there is a hotline that was stood up under the state of Colorado OEDIT office. You can either email or you can call them, and they answer the phones from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and kind of ask some of those questions. And if you need a regional resource partner and consultation, then they can set you up with an SBDC or another partner that can kind of navigate through the multiple layers of dealing with this on the business side. So, on to Paycheck Protection Program. I know you guys have already had the song and dance about exactly what the PPP is, but just a really quick reminder, it's a 100% guaranteed loan. It's delivered by our national network of lenders. Of course, it's designed to provide that direct incentive for small businesses, ag producers, and some nonprofits to keep employees on payroll or to reestablish employees onto a payroll that looks like the pre-pandemic time. So, it's for most small businesses and ag enterprises and nonprofits generally with less than 500 employees. The way the loan amount is determined is based on payroll costs over a historical period plus fringe times 2.5. That did not change under the Flexibility Act. The loans can still be forgiven, and we will forgive all the loans. We'll forgive loans if all the employees are either kept on the payroll or they're rehired to pre-pandemic levels for now under the Flexibility Act through the 24-week period following origination. And then the money also has to be used primarily for those payroll expenses and a little bit up to 40% for rent, mortgage, interest, or utilities and overhead costs. Like I said, the amount changed in the Flexibility Act, and we'll go a little bit into that. If there is any amount that rolls over into a loan, then the loan payments now under the Flexibility Act will be deferred for a period of 10 months, and we'll talk about why that happens. We still don't have collateral or personal guarantees required. The lenders aren't re-underwriting these loans based on some other credit criteria. Neither the government nor the lenders are charging small businesses any fees to originate these loans. Now under the Flexibility Act, new loans made after June 5th will have a maturity of 5 years, and the interest rate is still 1%. Through the second round of PPP funding, as Dan said, nationwide, there were almost 4.5 million loans totaling over $511 billion. In Colorado, there were almost at 100,000 PPP loans valued at over $10.2 billion. So this was money that was approved for Coloradans over the course of both rounds of funding. The average loan size in Colorado was a little over $104,000. So I think combined with two rounds, we are really, really trying to get to the smallest of the small businesses and make sure that we're covering everyone we can that has a need for these funds in Colorado. We all know that the Flexibility Act was passed last week, and I'm going to briefly summarize some of the key provisions as they were stated in the Act, but I have to give you an important disclaimer, and that's that, as you guys know, the PPP program is jointly administered by SBA and the Department of Treasury. So right now we're in the process, after the act was signed, of promulgating all the new rules and the guidance on implementation of all these new provisions. And of course, we're going to work to revise the current forgiveness application. So for Q&A, please excuse both Dan and my inability if we can't answer the real, real specific technical questions about the new guidance on the who, what, when, where, why, and how. I know how is the most important question until we have that guidance officially in place. But in summary, here's what the Act does. So it changes the covered period under which the loan proceeds can be used. So originally we said they had to be used 8 weeks after disbursement. Now they can be used through 24 weeks. So instead of the covered period ending on June 30th, it would actually be between February 15th of 2020 through the end of December of 2020. So that, in essence, that has the effect of extending the period also for when a business can actually apply for that loan forgiveness. So it was, you know, from 6 months now to within 10 months of the last day of the covered period before even you have to start making interest and principal payments if there's any loan that rolls over. Also, under the new bill, PPP loan interest and payment of principal and fees will be deferred, and that's until the loan is forgiven by the lender. The borrowers can now use that 24-week period to restore your workforce levels and wages to pre-pandemic levels required for full forgiveness. Current PPP borrowers can choose to keep the 8-week period, or they can ask to, or they can extend the period as long as you request forgiveness by the end of December. The covered period can't extend beyond that 12/31 date. The Flexibility Act also lowered the requirement to spend any amount on payroll from 75% to 60% in order to maximize that forgiveness. Or I guess a better way of saying this is that now you may use up to 40% to cover those eligible overhead costs. So hopefully this provides some flexibility to address additional business expenses that you have associated with, like payments of interest on covered mortgage obligations, payments of any covered rent obligations or utility payments. It also increased the time to, to request forgiveness from 6 months to 10 months, and that's to accommodate the extended covered period. It also changed the maturity on any loans, like I said, that are approved after June 5th from 2 years to 5 years. If you're already a PPP client and you have a two-year term, there has to be a mutual agreement between the lender and yourself to take advantage of that additional maturity. That would be something that you would have to work out with your lender and requesting the lender. That's if you already have a PPP loan. So we can't compel lenders to extend the terms, nor can lenders compel you to accept a longer term that would be between you guys. The interest rate is still going to remain at 1%. Actually, under the Flexibility Act, it also gave some ability for recipients to now delay payments of payroll taxes that were prohibited under the CARES Act before. So businesses can also qualify for the tax credits to defer payroll taxes, I should say. The legislation also includes two new exceptions that allow borrowers to achieve that full PPP loan forgiveness, even if you don't fully restore your workforce. Previous guidance we had already issued had already allowed borrowers to exclude employees who turned down your good faith offer to rehire them at the same hour and wages before the pandemic. But now the new bill allows borrowers to adjust just because they could not find qualified employees, or if you were unable to restore business operations to pre-COVID levels due to like related operating restrictions, or if we have guidance that comes down from HHS or OSHA or CDC that doesn't allow you to operate at that full level, then there are ways to claim exemption so that you can still maximize forgiveness. As Dan said, one really important note is that there is still a deadline to apply for these funds. So even though the covered period shifted to the end of December to give you more flexibility, the applications still have to be approved by June 30th. So that means approved, we mean that the lender has reviewed, they've entered the information, and they've received the SBA approval by the end of that day. So if you're looking to apply for PPP now, don't stand on ceremony, don't wait till the last day, because there is an expectation that lenders are still looking at and verifying the information. They need a couple of days to look at it, to go through whatever process they do to enter it into whatever system they're using to ask SBA to approve it and to issue an approval number. So give yourself enough lag time. And with that, I think we'll stand for questions.
I have a question.
Thank you, Francis. Go ahead.
Me? Hello?
Yeah, please go ahead.
In the early days in March, I had filed for two EIDL loans because we've got a ranch and a transportation company. I didn't hear anything until 2 weeks ago on the transportation company. And on the ranch, you know, we're in big trouble because we're in drought and hay costs are going to be bad. And anyway, so I filed for the ranch and I never heard anything. So I thought, well, maybe there was some problem with my application or, you know, electronics being what they are. Maybe it disappeared into the ethers. And so I filed again. And then I got a response saying we have multiple applications. And so we have canceled them all except for your original one, which listening to the podcast here, mine does start with a 3. So then I filed again, thinking, well, you know, I'll just keep bugging them. And then they said, well, we're not considering this because the only thing we're funding right now is agricultural. And I'm thinking, well, L7 Ranch is agricultural. Mm. So I don't understand what I need to put in there to make it clear that it's agricultural.
Dan, you want me to take that?
No, let me grab that real quick, because okay. What I'd love to do is get your number and talk to you offline and see if we can figure this out.
Sure.
Let's see here. And your number just was up. It was but can you just provide, is it 719-541?
Yes. Yep, that's far enough. Yep.
Okay.
I'll
call you right after this and we'll try and figure out what's going on. Go ahead.
And then my bank, we've tried and tried and tried and tried and tried through the bank to apply for PPP, and we have consistently been told, well, we're not taking any more applications. And we said, okay. So then the first phase closed and the second phase opened up, and I went back and I tried and tried and tried, and they said, well, we're not taking any more applications. We're just going to do what was in the backlog. And I thought, well, okay, what do you do with that?
Well, I can address that. I mean, I have a list of lenders that are working throughout Colorado. Some of them are headquartered in Colorado. Some of them are regional. Some of them are national. In addition, we also have a number of what we call community or mission-based lenders. These are lenders like community development financial institutions that are more interested in the economic driver activity, and they don't have to take your deposits. They're non-depository. So there were 3 in Colorado that are authorized. And if your loan amount that you're requesting under PPP is basically under $150,000, you can go to them. And again, you don't have to move all your accounts. You don't have to do any of that. They don't need your deposits. They're just looking to do the greater good for the community through their mission work. So Colorado Lending Source is one. Colorado Enterprise Fund is another. And an organization called DreamSpring, they were formerly known as Acción. They are our mission-based PPP lenders in Colorado. But I do have a list, and I will make sure and share it with the organizers of this call. And it will show you all the financial institutions that are basically authorized in Colorado to do PPP. So don't stop at just your own lender.
Well, they were authorized to do these. They just seemed completely disinterested. They said, well, you know, we've gone through our money, and it was just really a zero. So anyway, I thought I'd bring that up.
You know, And sometimes it's hard for a lender to let you know that, you know, they have a liquidity cap. So and their loan deposits and the way it works in banks and with their regulators, it can only lend up to a certain amount. So if they've sort of hit their, let's just call it their roof on lending, then by regulation, they would have to stop. I don't know if that's the case, but sometimes they're shy to tell you that. It doesn't mean they're not liquid. It doesn't mean they're not solid. None of that. It's just, you know, a regulator issue. So let's find you another lender.
Okay, that'd be good.
I'd also mention to you, Farm Bureau Bank is now an SBA-approved lender as well, and they are prioritizing work on SBA loans for Farm Bureau members. So please feel free to reach out if you're interested to Farm Bureau Bank as well.
Okay. I am a Farm Bureau member, so.
Awesome. On that note, we know the Flexibility Act changed, but you can still use the same application form. Just make notes of the difference. Pay no mind to where it says you have 8 weeks to spend this. We all know now you have up to 24, and that's a maturity of 5 years.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Oh, I'm in.
Hello, this is Laura Nagle in Cuyahoga County. Can you hear me?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, I have one question about qualified expenses. I've heard this going back and forth numerous different ways. We provide health insurance for our employee, and then, of course, also it's a group plan, and I am part of that health insurance, and we've been told that the premiums for employee health plans are considered a covered expense. Is that true? Because I've had literature come to me from the bank that says, well, we don't have any documentation that you can use those expenses. And then I've also gotten it elsewhere saying, yes, you can.
Dan, you got that, or you want me to take it?
Go ahead, Frances.
That's absolutely correct. You can include any kind of pre-tax employee contributions for health insurance or other fringe benefits that are excluded from the taxable Medicare wages and CHIPS Act. But I can send you and make sure that you have a really nice, useful guide that is called, it's kind of a fact sheet. It's called How to Calculate the PPP Loan Amount. Sean, I'll make sure you guys have it. And it takes you through various scenarios so that you can go line by line about what's included in your calculation, depending on, again, what kind of business you are and how you file your taxes, et cetera. So if you're doing Schedule C and you have employees, it'll walk you through how do you add the owners, how do you add the payroll, how do you add the fringe, and then do the calculation. If you're a Schedule F filer, it'll discuss that as well.
Oh, okay. Yes, because one of the things we did do when we received the PPP funds was I set up a separate account because we were able to use our local community bank, and we just went ahead and had the money deposited into a self identified account that was separate from our other business accounts so that I could kind of try and more simply track some of these expenses coming through. But some of these are done through automatic withdrawals through the institutions that we have these expenditures through, and it's becoming a little bit difficult sometimes to switch back and forth between certain accounts. And so we can still use some accounts that go through a different account that we're paying with, correct? Just as long as we have verification through documentation, as you were saying, with our taxes, that those were legitimate business expenses. We don't have to have any kind of a special account that we need to take them out of in order to track the flow.
No, not at all. And I think it's nice to have a best practice to have set up a segregated account, but that's not required. I mean, it might help you to track it a little bit for forgiveness at the end, just in the loan amount. But whatever you have that backs up, first, one, that they're eligible expenses and that they existed, and two, that you actually paid them during the time period, when you're ready to ask for forgiveness, that's all you really need.
Okay, thank you very much. It sounds like our accountant's going to have hire another person to help everybody with these figures.
You know, it's interesting. We have had trades that have designed different kind of calculators. And, of course, now that the Flexibility Act is passed, we'll all have to redesign all the macros, right? But there are calculators that are out there in the universe that will sort of help you on the forgiveness side. I don't want to get too much into the weeds because I don't want anybody to be worried about that part. You have a little bit of breathing room between now and when you would have to do that. But hopefully we will have tools when it comes to that point.
And also on the forgiveness forms and that whole process, you know, we do have some breathing room. So I think that's exactly right. I want to reiterate that. I also think, you know, I can certainly convey that Congress, in both a bipartisan and bicameral way, has requested that SBA and Treasury simplify that forgiveness process and some of the forms associated. So we're hopeful that will be the case as well. So stay tuned.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And since we have an existing PPP that came out before the latest changes, we just need to contact our lender and ask them that, or inform them that we would like to have that extension for the 24 months. And then did you say we also needed to discuss with them the repayment on the stuff that's not eligible for loan forgiveness? So both of those two items, we need to have a conversation with our lender about taking advantage of the extension, correct?
At this point, a conversation is all you can have on the 24 extension. We have not given any guidance to lenders now, if, like, that we want to formalize that process for you to request that. But yes, a conversation is always good with your lender up front.
All right, then. Thank you for clarifying that for me. I appreciate that.
If there isn't anybody else, I have another question.
Go ahead.
Regarding the EIDL funds, I'm still a bit confused on what is permissive use. It says it is not to be used for repairs. That's kind of a difficult pill to swallow, because as a small business with two people and trucks and no income, repairs are one of the biggest parts of our business operating expense.
Yeah.
I mean, with the EIDL loan, I mean, the loans can be used to pay fixed debts, payroll, accounts payable, and other bills that couldn't be paid because of the disaster's impact. So that is some of the parameters. Now, when you mentioned repairs, did you speak with someone specifically about that, or what was the give us the point of reference where somebody told you that was not permissible?
It was in the contract.
Here's what I would do. I'll let you know, because you're probably talking about the loan authorization or the loan agreement once you get the long-term loan, and yeah, it does have a whole bunch of clauses and covenants in there. So when we say repairs and renovations, or, you know, dealing with some kind of physical disaster damage, that's absolutely true, because there's two different SBA disaster programs. One that fixes it, that's for physical damage, and then one for economic injury, which is what we're all operating under now. However, the EIDL loan is intended to kind of be a bridge of working capital, basically calculated over like what you might need for 2 or 3 months to get you through your normal course of business. I think Dan said it before. We're typically historically not used to working with agricultural producers, but cost of transportation is probably, or fixing your trucks or whatever it needs to happen, is probably a basic working capital need that you
that
have.
Is.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not something that the loan authorization was amended for, since we jumped in really quickly to start working with ag producers. Here's what I would do. Just make sure to cover yourself. You have your loan authorization. And, you know, there's different times in there where you have to report if you have other funds or whatever. Send an email back and disclose this is a regular working capital need for agricultural producers. We're not talking about building a structure. We're not talking about putting a new roof on a structure when we're talking about repairs. We're talking about something that would happen in the normal course of a working capital expense for your type of business. So just make sure to document that and note that back. And then we can follow up on that one as well, Dan.
Yeah, and this is part of the challenge, because this program, again, within the past 2 months, has been really turned on its head and changed completely, where this was more or less a response mechanism for localized natural disasters. Now it's a nationwide response. And then in addition to that, we're now servicing agricultural enterprises. And when you look at some of the language in the contract and some of the stipulations, it doesn't necessarily conform to ag producers and some of the things and for rural small businesses. To me, repair of machinery and you know, things of that nature that helps with your business, that is a working capital expense.
Exactly.
You know, so that's,
you know,
where
it's hard to separate the spirit of the law from the letter of the law when you sign a contract that says that. So we're a little bit frightened of straying.
No, I appreciate that. We will take that back as well.
Okay. Did you say you were going to refresh the lenders? You had listed three that probably should be contacted.
I will send you a PDF that has all of the lenders in Colorado.
Okay.
That are working on PPP, and I'll make sure that the Bureau has it.
Okay. And then, are you still going to call me after this deal to talk about the farm or the ranch?
Yes, ma'am.
Perfect.
Any other remaining questions for Dan Francis?
Let me give you an email for anybody who is stuck on any particular issue and you want to get contacted by my district. The email box to send something is Colorado DO, as in district office, ColoradoDO@sba.gov. And if you'll do me a favor, put in the subject line what you are looking to get answered, whether it's EIDL or it's PPP, and then we can make sure that you're getting connected to the right people. I check that box 20,000 times a day, so you will get answered. I just want to make sure that you have a way to get a hold of one of us, even if it is for us to give you the 1-800 number to disaster because you can't remember, or again, if you're stuck on something.
And that's ColoradoCO@sba.gov.
DO as in district office. DO stands for district office.
Oh, D
as in dog.
Sorry.
Yeah, DO. D as in dog.
D as in dog.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that, please?
Absolutely. Colorado, DO at SBA. Gov. And if I can stop yapping, I'll get on the chat and I'll put it in there for you guys.
Is that the best way, or is there a phone number as well we can call somebody?
That's the fastest way to get to one of us. To be honest with you, all of our phones are ringing off the hook all the time. And so the minute that we empty our voicemail boxes, they're full again. Send me an email, and I check this constantly, and I will direct it to a staff member immediately if I don't answer it myself.
All right, Dan and Francis, we want to be respectful of your time. We certainly appreciate you coming on this morning. And I've got a few additional reminders and updates for members on the call, so please feel free to jump off because we've got some Farm Bureau-related stuff here. But thank you again for jumping on this morning.
No, thank you, Sean. We appreciate the opportunity. Let us know if we can further be of assistance. So thanks again.
Thank you again, and I'll follow up with all the promises.
And Dan, I hope to hear from you soon.
Yes, ma'am. I'll call you here shortly.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, guys. Just a few quick updates as it pertains to Farm Bureau business. All of you might have seen in your email inbox that came with the notification for this call. There is a bill up in the legislature right now that's going to be a significant tax increase on farms and ranches and small businesses across the state of Colorado. Emily Ibaugh is on. Emily, would you like to give folks some of the high points of that legislation? And then also we're asking everybody, once Emily hops off of mute, we're asking everybody to please take part in the call to action that was included in that email. Just click the button, fill out your information, and make sure an email gets sent to legislators so that they know Farm Bureau's feelings on this issue.
Yes, thank you, Sean. Good morning, everyone. Like Sean said, this is Emily Ibaugh, Director of State Affairs, and we are working hard in the trenches of the last few days of legislative session, what we hope will be the last 2 days of legislative session. We do have a bill. It's House Bill 1420. It was introduced late in the afternoon on Monday, was heard in committee yesterday, and is expected to be heard on second today. It's moving very quickly. It'll be over to the Senate by tomorrow, if it passes, which the House has it is expected to pass through the House. However, what House Bill 1420 does is it is a, like Sean said, a significant tax increase on farms and ranches, kind of in a backdoor way. So what it does is changes your ability to, in the treatment of net operating losses and your ability to carry them back for a loss or carry them forward. And my computer just died, so that's great. But regardless, it also changes the abilities of the 199A forms that you all use, and those that use those deductions in kind of a fluid way as your farm income maybe fluctuates. So, like Sean said, we do have an action alert out. This bill would be very detrimental to your abilities to manage your farm income, the way you do accounting, things like that would just be significantly impacted. There's some caps in there currently of, like for net operating losses, it caps it at $400,000. We know that that is a low number, and that farm losses can often be more than that, especially in years of bad hail or a peach crop freeze or whatever it may be that Mother Nature throws at us. So we are actively working. Like I said, this bill was heard in committee yesterday. We're actively working to, well, first of all, kill the bill, but there's also some interest in some amendments moving forward. So that being said, we need all of the firepower we can get. So please check your emails if you haven't submitted a call to action to the legislature. If you have, thank you so much. They're definitely hearing us on this one. If you haven't, you can find it on Colorado Farm Bureau's Facebook page. You check your emails. You should have an email about it for the call to action. Just follow the links, fill out the call to action. You can even put a personal note in there, which I know legislators always appreciate. If you have a personal circumstance or a personal story you would like to share, that is extremely helpful as well. So please do that, and we will. There's a number of other bills still moving, but this one has turned into a number one priority for us to either kill or at the very least amend. Farm Bureau is sitting in an opposition position. The board of directors took that position after the bill was introduced on Monday. So we'll continue to work hard for you all at the Capitol, and we'll fight hard till the end, which they're still shooting for Friday. They're moving things very quickly now to be done on Friday. So buckle up.
Is that did you say it was Facebook or a website?
So the call to action is on the Colorado Farm Bureau's Facebook page. You should also have an email about it. Taylor sent out an email yesterday, kind of mid-morning-ish, on the call to action. So you can find it in both places. It's probably, Taylor, you can correct me or Sean if I'm wrong. It's probably on our website as well, coloradofarmbureau.com, under the take action, under policy, and then take action. It should be on the website as well. So lots of places to find it. If you need to go find it there to fill that out.
If I may, Emily, this is Laura. In regards to this, I did take action, and I blanketed it my messenger with everybody and my contact list with it as well. But one of the things is this bill.
Thank you, Laura. That's great.
You aren't one of the people I blanketed to because I know you know it. But anyway, so I understand from my daughter who works with the SBDC that it's not just any, it's not just ag, it's all small businesses. Is this correct? Is this still, because that's something we oftentimes, we're preaching to the choir, because we have Senator Crowder and Representative Holtorf, and I'm sure they're going to vote against this bill. So we're kind of preaching to the choir with our personal representatives for those of us who are in the deeply rural communities. But there's a lot of ag producers that are also in communities along the Front Range that have representatives who are probably in favor of this passage of this bill. And I was trying to get people outside of ag aware of it as well. And not just business owners that are also small business owners that may be affected, but just consumers of business products. And so that I was trying to get that out as well. And I didn't know if you might have a press release. It's too late for our local newspaper, but I know a lot of them have their own Facebook pages that they can post relevant news. And I didn't know if you could send a press release out, because I know this is moving fast, so it probably won't get in print, but a lot of people check the Facebook pages on some of these.
Yeah, Laura. So to answer your question, yes, this does, it applies to everyone. I mean, it changes. It changes tax structure across the board. And there's a wide coalition of groups opposed to this. The South Metro Denver Chamber submitted testimony yesterday. The Colorado Bankers Association was there in person to testify. The Colorado Chamber of Commerce was there to testify in opposition. I mean, the opposition is widespread on this. We had, and with our Facebook post, it was shared over 172 times. A lot of that by members of, say, Action 22 or other. I think the Fence Post shared it as well, their Facebook page. So at this point in time, I think our action alert has really been widespread shared. If you haven't shared it on your own Facebook page, I would encourage you to do so. But yes, this really would affect small businesses as much as it would farms and ranches. Obviously, we've kind of honed in on the farm and ranch piece as far as Farm Bureau is concerned, just because we have such a unique relationship with weather and Mother Nature, and how that really affects our farm and ranch losses from year to year, as well as commodity prices and things like that. But it will definitely it could has the potential to just decimate small businesses, especially as COVID-19 is concerned. Some of the smaller restaurants and stuff along the Front Range here in Denver or in the suburbs will easily hit that $400,000 cap with losses this year, just because their restaurants were closed for 3 or 4 months. And so that's definitely a concern as this bill is situated. But like I said, it's moving very, very quickly. So time is of the essence. If you have friends in the small business world that need to react, please feel free to use our call to action. You can also, you know, like I said, you can put a personal message in. So and this call to action is also going to the full House right now. So it's going to every member of the House. It's not just sometimes we do a committee first and then the whole chamber if we need to, but this one we send directly to the whole chamber because we felt it was that important. So as you fill out the call to action, it is not just going to your specific legislator, it is going to the full House. And if this does pass the full House, we will do another call to action, which will be as important, if not more important, to the whole Senate as well. So this is going to be a race to Friday to really just keep the pressure on, especially on this bill. We did put a link in the call to action to find your own legislator, so those who do live maybe on the Front Range would have a chance to find their own legislators and give them a call. But you know that the call to action is not specific to your specific legislator. It is going to all 65 members of the House of Representatives.
Well, thanks for clarifying that, Emily, because I did not know that, because it requested us to enter our district number. And so I just assumed it was going to be going only to my specific legislators. I did not realize that it was going to everyone. So thank you, because one of the things I mentioned in my message was ag it was very instrumental in pulling Colorado out of the last recession. That was, you know, mm-hmm. pretty amazing that our industry did so, and we're a huge part of it. And of course, not realizing that for sure that other small businesses were impacted as well. We know that small business owners in particular are like, I think I may be wrong on my quote, but I think I'm close, at least 50% of the economic driver when it comes to business is small mom and pop and smaller businesses. So thank you for making that clear that everyone was going to see it. I appreciate that.
Yep, absolutely. And to just kind of further hone in on how great you all have been and how important this is, I just got a text from a Democrat legislator in the House asking me how she can help. So please keep the pressure on.
This
is going to be important.
Well, thank you, Emily. Final thing that we wanted to mention on today's call, and it's sort of another little bit of a downer. But the board of directors met a couple of days ago, and as a result of how the state is transitioning to safer at home and how groups meetings are being treated, the board made the decision to cancel Summer Ag Issues Summit for this year. The difficulty with trying to pull that many people together in Summit County, which is under more strict sort of lockdown provisions than a number of other areas around the state, was one of the deciding factors in that decision. So we're definitely going to miss you all at the Summer Ag Issues Summit, but we need to replace that in some way. And staff has been talking about how to fulfill that part of the policy development process. And one thing I wanted to get feedback from members on the call this morning was to sort of walk you through a couple of the options that we had thought of. We can do five separate and distinct advisory committee calls, if you would like, similar to what we've done in the past, but have that be a little bit more of the business and idea generating session like we do at Summer Ag Issue Summit. We can do specific deep dive kind of in-depth calls with staff and guests if necessary on specific issues. Like wolf issues and wildlife issues, tax issues, things like that, would be surfaced by staff and the board and members. So have those calls specific to issues, or we could do one big, huge call with everybody, and knock it all out at once. And I'm sure there's other ways we might be able to split the baby here, but those are sort of the initial ways that staff had thought of trying to backfill for not having us face-to-face at Summer Ag Issues Summit. And so would open the floor to thoughts from you members on what you think might work the best.
Well, this is Laura again, and you can always count on me to say something, correct? I think that maybe a combination of the aforementioned, what you said. I know people get tired of having constant teleconference, but they've actually had some good documentation that trying to convey information and do it strictly through Zoom or teleconferencing can be somewhat overwhelming. Our human brains don't work the best that way. And so I think perhaps trying to do a big, massive, huge, in-depth on everything all one may not be the most effective for us to get, you know, everyone up to speed. So I would suggest maybe doing the little bit, you know, little bites of some of these things, either through the advisory committees or through the issue topics. And then after you've kind of had a chance for people to become familiar with it and kind of digest it and kind of put some input in, then maybe bring it all together in a more streamlined form where everyone can kind of have all the topics at the table, but perhaps not have all the huge background discussion at the same time. Does that make sense?
Well, I second that.
No, it does, Laura, and that's kind of where we were leaning, but certainly wanted to put all the options out there for sure.
This is Sue again, and I just want to go on record to say some of these computer-based things are just impossible because we don't have decent internet out here. So, you know,
sure.
If the feds and the states could hurry up and get us good internet, we'd love that, but we can't do the computer-based things because they don't stream well. So the call-in options are really awesome.
Yeah, that was something that we haven't had too much of an issue, Cuyahoga County. We're pretty blessed that we have some good internet here in Cuyahoga County. But I do know a number of my colleagues elsewhere have said the same frustration.
Yeah, we're in Elbert County, eastern Elbert County, and boy, it's just really bad.
Well, and perhaps with some of the smaller upfront conversation groups that we have, then I don't know if the staff would be interested. They could put bullet points together, perhaps a condensed version that we can access, you know, through a link when we do have accessibility to a conference, and we can look at like a either a PDF version of the bullet points or something. We can just send stuff out that kind of puts it all together in a print form after we've had the verbal conversation before we have the big discussion.
You know, that's a nice thing, but then you miss out on your opportunity to ask questions and whatnot if there isn't a call-in link, if there isn't a call-in number.
Yeah, Sue, I think we should still do the verbal conversation, but just do a recap in writing. After the verbal conversation and exchange has gone on back and forth, like we're doing now, then
agreed.
Kind of have someone to do a written recap of the topic or the conversation so that, you know, pros, cons, questions, facts, for people to review.
Any other thoughts from anybody else on the call? Laura, too, I appreciate the feedback there.
Well, I always like it when I find out that other people are thinking the same thing, because you know how great minds think alike, and I think Farm Bureau is made up of great minds.
Okay. Somebody mentioned in the chat using a platform like Slack or something along those lines to be able to highlight specific issues and have people comment and that sort of thing. That's an interesting idea. We will certainly look into that. I like that idea. Well, with that, I think we can close for today. Just a reminder to keep a watch on Facebook and your email for when additional action alerts come out on this past legislation. This is a really, really, really significant one, and everybody's jumped in really well so far, so we want to keep up that momentum when it moves over to the Senate. So keep your eyes peeled for that. Make sure to share it with family and friends and colleagues and folks down the road. When you do get that into your email inbox, we want to get as many people weighing in on this as possible. So,
I want to let you know I did not get the call to action. I'm looking for it on the website, on Colorado Farm Bureau's website now, and I did find it so that I can send a letter, but it didn't get to my inbox. Who knows why?
How did you find the information for this call, Sue? It should be
This call, but for the legislative hot issue.
Yes.
For the House
the
bill.
The information for the login.
Yeah, I didn't get the call to action email.
Yes, that was included in the same email with
you know, I didn't
this
see it.
Information.
That's interesting. I'm going to have to go back and read for comprehension, I guess, but I didn't see it.
Yeah, Taylor included it in the last couple of emails and in Policy Watch on Tuesday. So it should be all together. So, well, thank you all again.
And,
I appreciate you jumping on this morning. Much appreciated.
We appreciate
you.
Thank you very much.